When the FBI raid happened on July 8, 2025, it wasn't a raid on trafficking rings or dark web marketplaces. It was at a trailer in Indianapolis, arranged via Snapchat. A 32-year-old mother, a 7-month-old infant, an offer to pay $400 for a child's sexual abuse. The platform known for disappearing snaps became a permanent witness to a mother's desperate betrayal. In the ensuing weeks, the affidavit revealed a chilling truth. Over 7,000 messages exchanged between October 29th and November 1st, 2024, including 81 posts offering nude images for diapers, and the infant girl's safety was reduced to a line item. Even after Snapchat's A, I flagged the messages in early November, legal and bureaucratic wheels ground to a horrifying stop before justice intervened. As a legal analyst, I'm asking, how did this mother arrive at that decision? Was it despair or deliberation, or both? And how did a social platform's reporting become a lifeline so delayed it almost came too late? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favourite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Messages That Echo. It was July 18th, 2025, when I first read the affidavit. Standard court docket. Bond set at $100,000. 7 children in state custody. Next hearing scheduled for mid-September. A quiet-sounding docket for something this disturbing. But I've been doing this long enough to know. The smaller the file, the heavier the story. The subject was Morgan Stapp, 32 years old, a mother of 7 from Indiana. She was charged with attempting to traffic her 7-month-old daughter for sexual assault in exchange for $400. The method of contact? Snapchat. At first, it sounded too grotesque to be real, but by the second page, it was obvious. The screenshots were real, the investigation was real, and the messages? They were a horror story written in broken grammar and desperate emojis. One message read, "You can fuck her for $400. Half now, rest after. I'll send my address. I do live alone, and her dad is not in the picture." Another, "Need cash for diapers. I know it sound crazy, but she won't remember. I promise." That phrase, "she won't remember," echoed. Not because it was true, but because it was a rationalization, a moral shortcut, a chilling justification. This wasn't just a desperate woman. This was someone who had begun to believe her own horror made sense. The timeline. The messages were originally sent between October 29th and November 1st, 2024. That's what the forensics later confirmed. Over the course of just a few days, more than 7,000 messages were exchanged from her device, including 81 that allegedly offered images of her daughter or suggested arrangements to exploit her in person. The platform's automated moderation system flagged the account for suspicious activity. An alert was sent to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The chain of custody was activated. The FBI was notified. A detective was assigned. And then, time passed. That's the part no one likes to talk about. 10 days from report to law enforcement awareness, but 8 months from that first flag to the actual arrest. 8 months. During that time, the messages remained evidence, dormant, horrifying, waiting for a prosecutorial green light. I've seen this before. The wheels of justice don't turn slowly because of apathy. They turn slowly because child trafficking cases require precision. Judges won't accept gut feelings. Prosecutors want digital trails, bank records, confessions. Investigators need photos, IP matches, statements of intent. They got them. all of them. But the cost was time, and that time, it's where the real danger lives. Who is Morgan Stapp? Not a stranger to the system, that was clear from her file. Two prior child services cases over the last 5 years: neglect, unsafe conditions, poverty, no removals, just monitoring. But the signs were there. She lived in a small home on the edge of a rural Indiana town. No stable job. No extended family support listed. 7 children under the age of 12. A mountain of pressure. Economic, emotional, maybe even psychological. Her arrest report listed no partner. No accomplice. Just her. When investigators arrived with a warrant to access her Snapchat, she allegedly claimed she didn't use the app anymore. Said the messages weren't hers. But her phone, her IP address, and her photos told a different story. The tech evidence was surgical. Exact login times, overlapping GPS coordinates, and messages that included selfies with her infant daughter holding up handwritten signs referencing the recipient's username. It was undeniable. She later claimed she never would have gone through with it. That she was just talking, just venting. That she needed money, but not like this. She cried in court, cried in the holding cell. But intent, in this case, was documented. She negotiated the act, named a price, set a location, even gave a window of time. The buyer. The man on the other end of the messages has not been named publicly. He is still under active investigation. But what's clear from the records is that he wired $100 up front through a digital payment service. The remaining $300 was to be paid upon pickup. Pickup never happened. Whether he got scared, ghosted her, or was intercepted, we don't yet know. But what's haunting is the clear implication that this wasn't her first attempt, only the first one caught. A system delayed. I don't blame the platform for flagging the messages. It did exactly what it was supposed to. Oh, I caught what a human never would have seen. It escalated the case. Law enforcement picked it up within days. But the bigger question is, why wasn't Morgan Stapp arrested back in November? The legal explanation is sound. Building a trafficking case, especially involving an infant, requires extraordinary evidence. But morally, ethically, it's harder to justify. Because while the gears turned slowly, a child remained at risk, lying in a crib, in that same home, with a mother who had already crossed a line. What the law sees. She's been charged with attempted child sex trafficking, a level 2 felony in Indiana. If convicted, she faces 10 to 30 years in prison. The court has already issued no contact orders for all 7 children. 2 were removed from the home immediately. The others followed shortly after. Her bond hearing was brief. A public defender entered a not guilty plea. The judge reduced the bond from $200,000 to $100,000. Still out of reach for someone in her situation. She remains in custody. The next hearing is scheduled for September. My notes. This case isn't about tech failure, it's about human failure. Morgan Stapp didn't use encrypted apps or underground forums. She used Snapchat, a mainstream app, the same one used for sending dog ear selfies and birthday videos. She used it to sell access to her child. And what's worse, she saw it as a solution, a transaction. Something to help buy diapers, pay rent, make it through the week. That's the part that lingers, the part that doesn't cleanly fit into a legal argument. Because the real danger isn't the dark web. It's the desperation that's visible in plain sight, in every town, on every phone. Chapter 2. Behind the Screens. How Social Media Enables Modern Trafficking. I've been asked more times than I can count. Why Snapchat? Why not the dark web? Why not some hidden encrypted app made for trafficking rings and predators? The answer is simple. Because it's easy. Because it's free. Because it's on every teenager's phone. Because it vanishes. And that vanishing, that false promise of invisibility, is what made it the perfect tool for Morgan Stapp. Not because she was a criminal mastermind, but because she believed no one would notice. That the messages would disappear before anyone could prove what she'd done. But they didn't. They stayed, in the background, on the servers, in a forensic trail that outlived the shame and the phone battery. And what they revealed wasn't just one woman's horror. It revealed a national failure to fully grasp the way modern trafficking operates in plain sight. The new marketplace. The myth of trafficking still lives in shadows for most Americans. The van snatching, the border smuggler, the stolen child in a foreign land. But the reality is colder and simpler. Today's trafficking starts in bedrooms, on phones, in messages sent while the kids are watching cartoons in the other room. Apps like Snapchat, Kick, Whisper, and Telegram weren't built for predators, but they weren't built to stop them either. Their structures reward immediacy, secrecy, vanishing content, and anonymity. Four pillars of exploitation. Morgan Stapp didn't need to code. She didn't need to know how to hack. All she needed was a Wi-Fi signal and a profile photo of her child. That's it. And she knew where to post it. She didn't post in public stories. She used private messages. DMS, disappearing snaps. Language that hinted, tested, softened. Baby pics for cash. I need help with formula. Just pics, no touching unless dollar dollars. Those messages didn't scream crime. They whispered it, enough to go unnoticed to a stranger. But ARRI? AI caught it. Still, the fact remains. She believed Snapchat would keep her safe. She wasn't wrong for 8 long months. Platforms that vanish. Snapchat's innovation, its entire brand identity, is based on the idea that what you send will disappear. But what most users don't know is that disappearing doesn't mean deleted. Messages flagged by users or algorithms are stored, reviewed, and escalated. That's how law enforcement eventually caught wind of what Morgan was doing. But the promise of secrecy is what emboldens users like her in the first place. I've seen this in countless cases. A teen lured into sending images, a predator pretending to be another child, an adult exploiting someone else's children for profit, all hiding in plain sight behind usernames like MomOff3 or XcuteBabiesSnaps. It's not dark web stuff, it's everyday internet. The danger isn't out there, it's right here. The reporting pipeline. Here's how it works when something gets flagged on a platform like Snapchat. User or AI flags. A message. Either a recipient reports it, or the app's content scanner detects something that looks like CSAM, child sexual abuse material. Internal safety team review. Snapchat's trust and safety team reviews the flagged content. If it meets the threshold, they generate a report. Report to NCMEC. That report is sent to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which processes thousands of such tips per day. Referral to law enforcement. If the report includes US-based users or child endangerment, it's escalated to the appropriate federal agency, often the FBI. Case opens, or doesn't. From there, it becomes a matter of prioritization. Resources, probable cause, evidence thresholds, and sometimes delays. In Morgan's case, everything worked. The message was flagged, it was reported, it reached the right people. But then came the wait, and that's where the system shows its cracks. Delays that in danger. By the time law enforcement acted in July, Morgan's messages had been sitting in digital purgatory for 8 months. 8 months where she still had access to her children, still had her phone, still had her accounts. During that time, no emergency removal order was filed, no arrest warrant, no search of her home. Why? Because the messages weren't enough, not yet. Prosecutors know better than anyone. If they move too soon, the case collapses. One procedural misstep, one unverifiable piece of metadata, and the defense can argue entrapment, coercion, or manipulation. So they waited. They gathered. They triangulated data. They built a net, carefully, silently, until they could act with certainty. But from a moral standpoint, it's hard to explain to the public why a woman offering her baby for rape could remain free for almost a year. Harder still to explain it to that baby. A culture of normalization. What we often miss when we talk about trafficking is how normalized these conversations have become in certain corners of the internet. Morgan's messages weren't filled with shock or hesitation. They were blunt, casual, even transactional. She discussed meeting times like they were pickups at daycare. She asked for payment apps the way someone asks for gas money. She said things like, she won't remember, as if that ended the debate. That's the culture we've built. One where emotional distance makes moral collapse easier. One where trauma is repackaged as content. One where the most vulnerable are often the most invisible. When I read those messages, I didn't just see a crime. I saw a society that's drowning in silence. The real face of modern trafficking. Forget the chains, the locked rooms, the overseas flights. Modern trafficking looks like a living room and a phone. It looks like financial desperation. It looks like untreated postpartum depression. It looks like mothers who are isolated, unsupported, and terrified, making decisions that no one should ever face. And yes, sometimes, it looks like evil. But most of the time, it looks like a person who fell through every crack until the only thing she thought she could sell was her child. It's not sympathy. It's understanding. And without understanding, we'll never stop the next Morgan Stapp, or the one after her. My final thoughts. This case didn't happen in the shadows. It happened in the light. It happened on a mainstream app, on a phone bought at Walmart, in a neighborhood not far from my own. There was no mastermind, no ring, no cartel. Just a mother, a phone, a baby, and a platform that made her feel invisible. We talk about digital safety like it's a code to crack. But this case reminded me. It's a mirror. One that shows us what our culture enables and ignores until it's too late. Chapter 3. Desperation and Delusion. Inside the mind of a mother who offers her child. It's easy to call her a monster. It's easier still to stop there. Let that label do the emotional heavy lifting so we don't have to. We brand her, post the mugshot, feel the rage, and move on with a comforting belief. She's not like us. But as I sat with the full case file, hours deep into the evidence and timelines, I found myself confronting something far more difficult. Morgan Stapp wasn't some masked predator hiding in an alley. She wasn't running a ring. She wasn't the dark figure in a horror story. She was a 32-year-old single mum in rural Indiana. And in a moment of unbearable pressure, she offered her baby up for rape. The question that haunted me wasn't, How could she? It was. What broke her? And that's the question no one wants to answer. A pattern hidden in plain sight. There's a pattern I've learned to recognize. It doesn't begin with crime. It begins with collapse, poverty, addiction, isolation, overwhelm. You stack those together, and you start to see how someone like Morgan reaches a point of moral erosion. Not an explosion, an erosion. Slow, invisible, steady. According to case reports, she lived alone with her 7 children. No consistent income, no childcare, no family stepping in. Just her, a crumbling house and mounting needs. She posted online constantly, asking for diapers, second-hand baby clothes, cheap groceries, someone to buy her broken-down minivan. Some of the messages felt like cries for help. Others, cryptic, hints of resentment, exhaustion, phrases like, I'm drowning in kids, or no one would even notice if I vanished. Then came the shift. In late October, her tone changed. The online posts became shorter, sharper. She stopped asking for rides and started offering things, photos, private snaps, solo time, open to offers. All vague, coded, but they formed a breadcrumb trail towards something far darker. The psychology of fracture. One thing that never gets discussed in trafficking cases is how mentally unwell you have to be to justify selling your own child. This isn't just crime. It's cognitive collapse. Reading the forensic interviews, I noticed something chilling. Morgan didn't sound like someone reliving a traumatic mistake. She sounded emotionally detached, muted, like someone talking about another person's life. She told investigators she didn't remember sending the messages. Then she said she was just talking. Then she admitted, I thought he might just want to see her, not touch her. This is where delusion creeps in. The human brain, when overloaded by trauma or guilt, has a remarkable capacity for justification. She told herself that the money was for diapers, that the baby was too young to remember, that maybe it wouldn't even happen. She fractured reality in order to survive what she was doing. But justification isn't innocence, it's insulation. It's how people live with the consequences of what they've already done, or what they're about to. Isolation and invisibility. I keep coming back to this idea. Who was watching her? Because that's where the accountability system failed most profoundly. There were 2 prior reports with child services. The home was flagged for neglect, but no removal, no follow-up arrest, no community intervention, just forms, signatures, and another name on the spreadsheet. And meanwhile, Morgan was unraveling in silence. In communities like hers, rural, underfunded, forgotten, poverty is invisible until it becomes criminal. People disappear into trailer homes and fall through every safety net, until the only attention they get is when the sirens arrive. There were no therapists, no church outreach, no after-school programs, just Morgan, the pressure of 7 children, and the illusion of digital escape. Snapchat became her confessional booth, her negotiation table, her fantasy of income, her justification machine. No one stopped her, because no one was really watching. A history without help. We don't know the full details of Morgan's childhood, but public records show she bounced between addresses throughout her teenage years, dropped out of school, had her first child at 18. The fathers of her children? Absent. Unknown in some cases. Jail in others. What we do know is that she was likely a survivor long before she became a suspect. That's not a defense. It's an origin story. Too many trafficking cases begin with women who were once trafficked themselves, or abused, or forced to believe that bodies have price tags. And when survival becomes transactional, morality warps. Morgan wasn't selling a baby. She was selling relief from hunger, from noise, from fear, from her own crumbling sense of self. It's monstrous, but it's also human. And if we pretend it's only monstrous, we blind ourselves to the hundreds of others walking that same road right now. What I saw in court. When Morgan stood before the judge, she was wearing an oversized orange jumper and the look of someone already halfway gone. She cried, yes, but not the sobs of someone pleading for mercy. It was the quiet kind of cry, the kind that doesn't expect to be heard. The prosecutor laid out the facts, the messages, the images, the financial negotiation, the plan for pickup. Morgan didn't deny it. She just kept saying, I didn't think he'd actually come. Like that made it better. It didn't. Because the law doesn't require follow-through for a trafficking charge. It only requires intent. And Morgan's messages were a blueprint of intent laid out in digital ink. The judge read them aloud in court, one by one, her own words echoing back at her. Morgan stared at the floor. What we miss when we don't look deeper. There's a tendency in cases like this to stop at the headline. Indiana mom tries to sell her baby for $400. It's sickening, it's sensational, it goes viral, but it's also a missed opportunity. Because beneath that headline is a layered, uncomfortable truth. That someone can be both a mother and a monster. That someone can love their child and still offer them up for harm. That desperation doesn't always look like hunger. It sometimes looks like cruelty. And that no one arrives at that place overnight. If we want to stop the next Morgan step, we can't just focus on arrests. We have to focus on the roads people travel to get there. Which means earlier intervention, community support, mental health care, real monitoring, not just forms, not just threats. Because when a mother starts seeing her own child as currency, the collapse didn't begin with that message. It began long before. Chapter 4. The children. Left behind. Protection. Trauma. And the foster system's burden. After the arrest, the house went quiet. That's what the neighbors told investigators. For the first time in years, there were no sounds of children fighting, no front door slamming, no strollers left on the porch. Just silence. The kind that arrives when seven children are suddenly removed and the only adult in the house is behind bars. I've reviewed dozens of dependency cases, but this one lingers. Not just because of what Morgan Stapp did, or tried to do, but because of the ripple effect. This wasn't just one infant. It was seven children, all of them now in the custody of a system that was never designed to raise them, only to rescue them. And that rescue is complicated, messy, and often tragically incomplete. The emergency removal. On the day of her arrest, officers arrived at the house with more than handcuffs. They came with temporary custody orders, prepared by the Department of Child Services. The two youngest children, including the seven-month-old girl at the center of the case, were taken immediately. The others were picked up later that afternoon. From the case file notes, the scene was chaotic. One child cried so hard they vomited. Another tried to run out the back door. The oldest, just 12, stood in the hallway with clenched fists, asking only one question over and over again. Are we coming back? There was no answer, because no one knew. Trauma in the tiniest voices. What happens when children are removed from their home doesn't follow a single pattern. For some, it's a relief, an escape from abuse, chaos, hunger. For others, it's the shattering of the only world they've ever known. For Morgan's kids, it was both. According to emergency intake reports, none of the children had ever been formally diagnosed with trauma-related disorders. But foster interviews revealed immediate signs. Bedwetting, nightmares, refusal to speak, flinching at sudden sounds. The baby was reportedly underweight. Not dangerously so, but enough to raise a flag. She had a small burn on her leg, unexplained. It's unclear if that was from neglect or a simple accident. Either way, it became part of the file. The foster parents reported that she struggled to make eye contact, that she startled easily, that she didn't cry much. That, somehow, was worse. Because crying means trust. Crying means, I believe someone will come. Silence? That's a different language entirely. The foster system's crossroads. Indiana's foster system, like many others across the country, is overwhelmed. There aren't enough beds, not enough trauma-informed families, not enough caseworkers with the time, training, or resources to handle the complexities of a family like Morgan's. When all seven children were placed, they had to be split across four separate homes. Three siblings went together. Two went to a relative, unlicensed but willing. The youngest two were sent to emergency foster care in another county. That separation alone can be deeply destabilizing. Children who grow up in chaos often find security not in their caregivers, but in each other. When you remove that final bond, the sibling connection, you risk severing the last thread of familiarity they have. But there was no alternative. No single home could take them all. And so, one arrest fractured a family into four pieces. The psychological fallout. From a legal analyst's standpoint, the system followed procedure. Emergency orders were filed, risk was assessed, protective custody was secured. That's the structure. But from a human standpoint, what unfolded was something else entirely. Within days, the 12-year-old had stopped speaking. The 9-year-old became aggressive toward their new foster parent. The 6-year-old kept asking if Mummy was dead. And the baby. She didn't ask anything. But her body did. Her lack of weight gain, her stiff posture, the fact that she didn't reach for people, these were signs of what experts call attachment trauma, damage done before a child even has language to describe it. This is what people often forget in cases like this. Even if you save a child from further harm, you're not starting at zero. You're starting with negative equity, rebuilding a foundation that was cracked before they could walk. Interventions too late. According to DCS files, this wasn't the first time Morgan's parenting raised red flags. There had been two prior investigations, both closed, one for possible neglect, the other for environmental hazards. Neither resulted in removal. Home visits were conducted, resources were offered, but nothing stuck. And in fairness to the workers, they were likely dealing with dozens of similar cases. Limited time, impossible caseloads. A mandate to preserve family unity wherever possible. But here's the truth. By the time a mother is offering her baby for sex on social media, the system has already failed. Not just her children, her too. That doesn't excuse what she did. Nothing can. But it should recalibrate our sense of when intervention needs to happen. Not when a child's at the edge of a cliff, but when they're taking their first steps toward it. Permanency and uncertainty. As of now, the long-term placement for the children remains undecided. DCS is seeking termination of parental rights, but that process takes months, sometimes years. Morgan is in jail, awaiting trial. She's seen none of her children since her arrest, and no contact order was issued for all seven. And if she's convicted, it's unlikely she ever will again. But that doesn't mean the story ends there. Because now, the children are in limbo, and the foster care system, for all its good intentions, is not equipped for lifelong healing. It's designed for placement, not permanence. Protection, not parenting. Some of the children may be adopted. Others may age out. A few may bounce from home to home, never fully trusting again. That's the quiet toll of crimes like these. The damage that doesn't make headlines. The wounds that don't bleed, but still deepen every day. What we owe these children. We often talk about justice in terms of punishment, of courtrooms and convictions. But justice for these children can't be measured in years or sentencing guidelines. Justice looks like consistency, safety, love. It looks like a bed that doesn't move every 6 months, a school that doesn't change every September, a therapist who stays long enough to see real progress, a foster parent who doesn't quit when the behaviours get too hard. Justice looks like presence. Because the trauma they've endured is not just something to treat, it's something that rewires them, changes how they see the world, how they see themselves. And if we don't meet that trauma with deep, sustained care, we're not just failing these children. We're preparing the next case file, Chapter 5. Spiral. The Unraveling of Control. The media stopped calling by week 3. The public outrage, once white-hot, cooled into silence. Headlines gave way to newer crises. The mugshot faded from feeds. But the case hadn't slowed. It was intensifying. Behind the walls of Morgan County Jail, Morgan Stapp wasn't just waiting for trial. She was unravelling. And so was the illusion, the one she told herself and investigators, that she never really meant to go through with it. Because the deeper the forensic teams dug into her digital life, the clearer it became. This wasn't a one-time lapse. This was a pattern, a strategy, a controlled descent into something deliberate. And once it started, Morgan couldn't stop, or wouldn't. A digital spiral. After reviewing the warrant returns from Morgan's Snapchat account, it became apparent that the $400 offer wasn't the only disturbing message, not by far. Investigators recovered over 7,000 individual communications from her account. Of those, 81 messages involved either direct offers of her infant daughter for sexual activity or vague proposals that strongly implied it. But what changed everything wasn't just the content. It was how she escalated. Early messages were hesitant. Pics only, no touching. Later ones? Bold, coordinated, explicit. She had created preset options. Pics, $20. Live vid, $50. In person, $400 after 11 p.m. This wasn't just messaging. It was marketing. And somewhere in that spiral, Morgan crossed the line from desperation to operating a scheme. The client list. One part of the file chilled me beyond anything else. A list investigators pieced together from recovered chat IDs. It wasn't titled client list in her phone, but the frequency of contact combined with payments, photos, and message threads suggested it functioned as one. At least 4 individuals sent her money via various cash apps, amounts ranging from $10 to $200. While most conversations involved adult images of Morgan herself, 2 of those threads included disturbing language about the baby. In one, a man wrote, Send proof she's real. Quiet, right? Morgan responded, She good. Sleeps through anything. You tell me what you want. None of these individuals have been publicly named. The investigations are ongoing. But what's terrifying is how easy it all was. No website, no encryption, no gang. Just a mother, a smartphone, and Signal. The house she lived in. DCS investigators returned to Morgan's home two more times during the investigation. What they found wasn't the dungeon the headlines might suggest. It was worse because it was ordinary. Two bedrooms, thin mattresses, overturned bottles, diapers stacked next to cereal boxes, a leaking faucet, a freezer with only two things in it, frozen chicken nuggets and ice packs. There were children's drawings taped to the fridge, a pile of unpaid bills, a pink baby blanket in a laundry basket, still wet. In other words, a house on the edge. Not evil. Not monstrous. Just deteriorating. And in that deterioration, there was room for something terrible to take root. Shifting stories. When questioned again, Morgan's version of events shifted. She no longer denied the messages. She said she sent them during blackout moments. She began talking about hearing voices, feeling like her body didn't belong to her, describing herself as watching it happen. It's unclear whether this was a genuine descent into psychosis or a legal strategy in motion. Either way, the court ordered a psychological evaluation. The results were inconclusive. The psychologist noted signs of depression, unresolved trauma, and dissociative symptoms, but stopped short of diagnosing a full break from reality. She was found competent to stand trial. In legal terms, that means she understood what she did and could be held responsible. In human terms, it meant she was spiraling. But not insane. What the kids remember. Though sealed, portions of the DCS interviews with her children were summarized in court memos. They don't know what their mother did. They only know she disappeared, that strangers came, that their clothes were put in trash bags, that they were split apart. The eldest, 12, asked a caseworker, Is this my fault? Did I not help enough? Another child, 9, was reported to have hidden under a foster bed for days, refusing to speak, only crying at night. The baby didn't speak at all, not even babbling. But trauma doesn't always need words. It lives in silence, too. The spiral isn't just Morgan's. The more I looked at this case, the more I realized the spiral extended beyond her. It reached into law enforcement, strained to keep up with digital crimes, into tech companies trying to balance privacy with protection, into child services, overloaded and understaffed, into foster care, full of trauma survivors raising more trauma survivors, into our collective attention span, so quick to cancel and so slow to understand. We say we care about kids, but we wait until after they're offered up for sale to intervene. That's the real spiral, and it has no bottom. Chapter 6. Trial by Fire. The Courtroom. Battle. Over Morgan Stapp's fate. The courtroom was cold. Not in temperature, in atmosphere. In silence, in the way the air felt thick with judgment, even before a word was spoken. It was August 20th, 2025, Morgan Stapp's second court appearance since her arrest. This time, she was present in person, shackled at the wrists, eyes low, thin. Her orange jumpsuit looked like it weighed more than she did. The baby she was accused of trying to sell was in state custody. None of her 7 children were in the room. But their absence was loud. The case of State of Indiana versus Morgan Stupp had officially moved from probable cause to full-blown prosecution. And everyone in the room knew what was at stake. 30 years, minimum. Opening statements. Guilt and guiltier. The prosecution didn't waste time. They opened with the quote that had already made national headlines. "You can fuck her for $400. She won't remember." They read it slowly, intentionally, letting each syllable land like a stone dropped in water. And then they showed the jury a printed screenshot of the Snapchat exchange, cropped, time-stamped, raw. There were gasps in the room. The prosecutor continued. "This isn't a case about poverty. This is a case about intention. This is about a mother who made the conscious decision to sell her infant daughter for sexual assault. Not once, not maybe, 81 times, 81 messages, 81 chances to stop. She never did." It was direct, it was brutal, it was undeniably persuasive. Then came the defense. Morgan's public defender didn't deny the messages. That wasn't possible. The digital trail was conclusive. Instead, they leaned into mitigation. "This is not a monster. This is a woman with untreated postpartum depression, a woman drowning in poverty, 7 children, no help, and a complete mental break. We are not here to excuse what she did. We are here to understand why." They emphasized her prior cooperation with law enforcement, her breakdown at the time of arrest, her psychological history. But the jury didn't look convinced. And neither did the judge. The witnesses. The first key witness was the digital forensics investigator who reconstructed Morgan's entire Snapchat conversation history. He described, in painstaking detail, how the account had been flagged by Snapchat's automated system, how it was tied to her phone and her IP address, and how metadata confirmed the messages had been sent directly from inside her home, while her infant was present. The second witness was a child protective services investigator who had conducted a home visit after the arrest. She described the state of the house. Trash, unsecured chemicals, a crib with no mattress. She showed photographs. One juror winced at the image of an uncovered electrical outlet directly next to the infant's play area. The third witness was unexpected. A former neighbor. She testified that Morgan had once asked her if she knew anyone who could pay for pics. She thought Morgan meant modeling. "It felt off," she said, "but I didn't want to assume. Now I wish I had." The turning point. Then came the key evidence. The photo. A selfie sent by Morgan to the buyer, showing her baby holding a handwritten note with the buyer's screen name written in black marker. The baby's face was blurred in court, but the expression was unmistakable. Blank, unaware. Morgan's hands were visible in the shot, her nail polish chipped, her fingers tight around the paper. The timestamp proved it was taken minutes after the $100 payment had been received. The prosecution rested their case. It was devastating. The defense falters. Morgan's defense team called only one witness, a clinical psychologist who had evaluated her after her arrest. He testified that she met the criteria for major depressive disorder, postpartum psychosis, and had a trauma history going back to her own childhood. But under cross-examination, he admitted she was still legally competent, still capable of making decisions, still aware of the consequences. It was a damning admission. Because sympathy doesn't cancel culpability. Morgan speaks. Against legal advice, Morgan chose to testify. Her voice was fragile, breaking often, but she spoke in full sentences. I wasn't thinking, she said. I didn't even know what I was saying half the time. I was tired. I needed money for diapers. For food. I never thought anyone would actually do it. I just wanted help. She paused. Then added, I'm not evil. I'm just broken. For a brief moment, the courtroom was still. Even the prosecutor didn't move to interrupt. But then came the redirect. The prosecutor stood and read aloud another message Morgan had sent. $400 for the night. She quiet. I can bring her to you. Morgan had no response. She lowered her head. That was the last thing she said on the stand. Jury deliberations. The jury deliberated for less than 3 hours. That's fast in a case like this. It signalled what we already knew. The verdict was unanimous. Guilty on the charge of attempted child sex trafficking, a level 2 felony. No tears. No outbursts. Just Morgan, motionless, as the words landed like bricks. The judge ordered sentencing to be held 30 days later. In the meantime, she would remain in custody with no bail and no contact with any of her children. As she was led away, I caught her mouthing something. It looked like, I'm sorry. Or maybe it was just habit. Maybe it didn't mean anything anymore. Sentencing pending. Morgan now faces 10 to 30 years in prison. The judge has wide discretion. The prosecution is pushing for the maximum. The defense is pleading for the minimum, citing her trauma and lack of prior convictions. But the jury verdict speaks loudest. And for the public, the message is clear. A line was crossed that can't be uncrossed. Whether it was desperation, delusion, or some cocktail of both, the legal system rendered its judgment. But justice? That's more complicated. Because the children still need homes. Because the buyer still hasn't been caught. Because no sentence, not 10 years, not 30, can unwrite what was done. Chapter 7. Aftershocks. What this case says about America's fight against child exploitation. When the sentencing came down, it felt anticlimactic. 30 years. That was the maximum. The courtroom was quiet as the judge read the sentence aloud. Morgan Stapp didn't cry. She just stared straight ahead, her face neutral. It wasn't shock, it wasn't regret, it was resignation. And then it was over. A bailiff took her arm. She was led out of the courtroom, and the door clicked shut behind her. That's where most stories end. But that's not where this one ends, because if we're being honest, the story isn't about Morgan Stapp anymore. It never was. It's about what her case exposed. What it revealed about how we talk about, and more importantly, fail to prevent, child trafficking in America. The illusion of the exceptional case. Morgan's arrest shocked the public because it shattered their expectations of what a trafficker looks like. She didn't fit the cinematic mold. No dark alley, no foreign passport, no armed men. She wasn't part of a cartel. She wasn't an international smuggler. She was a mother. A neighbour. Someone people might have passed in the grocery store without thinking twice. And that's what made it unbearable. Because when someone like Morgan becomes the face of trafficking, the illusion collapses. The illusion that this only happens over there, or with people like that, or in places that don't look like ours. But exploitation doesn't live at the margins. It lives next door. In broken homes. On working class streets. On phones left charging beside baby bottles. A system built to react, not prevent. I've spent years analysing how our justice system handles child exploitation cases, and what's clear is this. We're good at reacting, at punishing, at locking people up after the fact. But when it comes to prevention, we're failing, catastrophically. In Morgan's case, two child services investigations were closed without escalation. Digital alerts flagged her account in November, but she wasn't arrested until July. No family services were provided beyond occasional welfare checks. There were no mental health interventions, no community safety nets, no proactive outreach. She didn't fall through the cracks. The cracks were the system. And her baby almost paid the ultimate price. The buyer still walks free. It's almost too absurd to say out loud. Morgan is in prison for offering her child. But the man who tried to buy that child is still free. His name has not been released. He has not been charged. He has not been arrested. The investigation, I'm told, is ongoing. And yet, that imbalance feels like a scream in a silent room. Because how do you claim justice has been served when half the crime remains untouched? This case didn't happen in isolation. It was a transaction, a sick agreement between two people. Only one of them will see a prison cell. The role of technology, savior or spectator. Let's be clear. Without Snapchat's AI system, this case may never have been discovered. Their content moderation algorithm flagged the phrase, baby for 400. It triggered an internal review. It was escalated to NCMEC and then passed to law enforcement. In that sense, technology saved a life. But let's also be honest. The delay in response, the 8 months between the flagged messages and the arrest, reflects a broken chain of urgency. It wasn't the technology that failed. It was what came after. The real-time tools exist. The detection systems are working. But they're only as fast as the bureaucracies interpreting them. And when those bureaucracies move slowly, children remain at risk. A call for accountability, not just conviction. We want to believe that prison sentences equal justice, that 30 years means closure. But what about the trauma left behind? The siblings separated, the baby in therapy, the foster homes strained, the social workers buried under impossible caseloads. And what about the next, Morgan? Because if we don't address the root causes, the poverty, the untreated trauma, the technological loopholes, the cultural apathy, then all we've done is put a bandage on a bullet wound. Morgan's story isn't a cautionary tale. It's a warning shot. It tells us where we are. It tells us what we've normalized. And it tells us what we're still refusing to see. What I'll remember. I've sat in courtrooms, read hundreds of pages of transcripts, and interviewed too many survivors to count. But what I'll remember from this case isn't the sentence. It's the silence of a baby who no longer cries, the silence of a buyer whose name remains hidden, the silence of a system that knew but waited, and perhaps most damning, the silence of a society that sees headlines like this and keeps scrolling. One last thing. There is no single fix, no app, no law, no raid that will stop every instance of trafficking. But we can start by changing how we see it. We can stop pretending that monsters live only in shadows. We can invest in prevention instead of only prosecution. We can hold buyers accountable with the same rage we reserve for sellers. We can pay attention to the kids, all the kids, before they become hashtags. Because if we wait until a mother is offering her baby to strangers, we've already failed her. And worse, We failed the child, who never got to choose any of it.